Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Homes.com knows that when it comes to home shopping, it's never just about the house or condo. It's about the home. And what makes a home is more than just the house or property. It's the location and neighborhood. If you have kids, it's also schools, nearby parks, and transportation options. That's why Homes.com goes above and beyond to bring home shoppers the in-depth information they need to find the right home. And when I say in-depth, I'm talking deep. Each listing features comprehensive information about the neighborhood, complete with a video guide. They also have details about local schools with test scores, state rankings, and student-to-teacher ratio. They even have an agent directory with the sales history of each agent. So when it comes to finding a home, not just a house, this is everything you need to know, all in one place. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey there, Mad Money fans. I am Becky Quick. Kramer's off tonight, but we have an action-packed hour coming your way on this CNBC special, Markets in Motion. Stocks making a major turnaround today, erasing some big early losses to finish well off their lows. The recent whipsaw action in the market and the looming threat of a recession has left many wondering how to piece together a game plan for the rest of this year and into next. Tonight, we will help you make sense of it all. We're taking a deep dive into the asset classes that have the markets on the move. We'll spotlight stocks to watch, including the latest action out of Twitter. Then, is the bond market a buy? It's been a tough year for the asset class, but one market expert says opportunity is knocking. Plus, drilling down on today's big move in energy after OPEC Plus announces a major production cut. And cash is king when the market tumbles, but after this recent move higher, we'll tell you where to put your money now. All of that is ahead on tonight's special hour. First, though, we want to get right to a quick check of the markets with our Mike Santoli. And Mike, down market today, but not nearly as down as it could have been.
Yeah, Becky, it's one of those days where a down 0.2% on the S&P 500 might seem like a relative win. That's both because at the morning lows, the S&P was down about 1.8%. And, of course, today comes after one of the strongest two-day rallies we've seen in years. S&P up 5.7% Monday and Tuesday. In the very short term, it seems relatively encouraging, although it only takes the S&P back to where we traded about 2 weeks ago. That shows you how nasty the slide was into the end of September. Bigger picture, I think one of the reasons stock markets have gotten some relief is the dollar index has eased back off its recent highs in the last couple of days. In fact, the morning high for the U.S. dollar index was around 11:30 a.m. It declined a bit from there. That's when stocks managed to get a bid because that's where really the Fed fears and hopes come together in the U.S. dollar index. If people think the Fed might be almost done tightening, or at least we can see a path to when it's done, the dollar can come in a little bit along with Treasury yields. Of course, lot is riding on the jobs number on Friday. That's going to tell us whether, in fact, the bond market and the currency markets have the Fed priced correctly, or at least it's going to help tell that story, Becky. And even today, a little bit of a hint of good economic news being bad news for the market. We got a strong ISM services number, and that's when markets briefly backed off in the morning.
The one thing that caught me by surprise, Mike, was just the VIX being down by about 1.8%. Yeah. I don't know if that's a sign of, okay, we've been through a lot the last five or six or eight trading sessions, or if that's a sign that, okay, a lot of people are out for the holidays, or if this is really a breather.
You know, it does show you that we're sort of normalizing a little bit in terms of expectations for volatility. We spent some time on the VIX above 30 several days going into the end of last week. It's easing back. Look, we're 6% off the lows in the S&P or thereabouts, 5.5-6%. That just gives a little bit of breathing room. I wouldn't necessarily say it means that traders are assuming it's all clear from here.
Mike, I've been watching you all day. Thank you for the heavy lifting and for sticking around. It's great to see you. We'll see you later.
Sure thing.
Let's talk more about the market action and how you should be positioned as we head into the rest of the year. Joining us right now is Jeffrey Sherman. He's Deputy Chief Investment Officer at Double Line Capital. This is the house that are the experts on bonds, and that's why we've got him here. Jeffrey, it's really good to see you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Becky.
I know it's never easy to figure out what's going on in the bond market. In fact, DoubleLine, I looked up your website today, and you guys talk about how no one can consistently predict changes on the level, direction, or term structure of interest rates. But you do say that when you're looking at the situation recently, this market was clearly oversold on a technical basis. You want to talk about what that looks like to you?
Yeah, well, if you look at the move up in yields we've seen, it really started with the front end of the yield curve. And it was the two-year rate that really started this new trajectory. And what happened is that after the July FOMC meeting, the market interpreted Chairman Powell's comments as being quite dovish, or at least they were close to peaking in the hiking cycle. And so you saw this big rally that transpired post-FOMC meeting back in July. And then all of a sudden, you had Fed governors come out in droves early the next week saying, wait a second, there's a misinterpretation of what we're trying to do here. And what was happening is, as you know, that the Fed is trying to tighten policy. They're trying to rein in inflation. They're doing that through the interest rate policy, as well as the unwind of their balance sheet via quantitative tightening. So if you put these two things together, that's the Fed's objective, to tighten policy. But if rates rally, if credit spreads tighten in, that creates a looser financial condition. It makes it easier for financial conditions. And so what happened is you saw the Fed governors come out in droves, say, no, you misinterpreted what we're trying to do. And since then, the bond market really listened. We had inflation data that spooked the rates market. We had also just some of the economic data, although it's been a mixed bag, things like the labor market have been quite strong. And we know that the Fed sees the relationship between labor and inflation rates. And so put this all together, what happened is over the course of about 9 weeks or 8 weeks, we saw that the two-year Treasury rose almost 150 basis points. And what it did, it brought the rest of the Treasury curve with it. And it was really just nonstop selling of bonds over that period. And so just like in the stock market, when things get oversold, you're due for a slight rally. And so we saw that last week as well. And so we've seen a little bit of that rally. We've seen kind of consolidation across the tape right here. And right now, the Treasury market is looking for guidance. And as Mike said at the top of this segment, right now, it's all eyes on the job report this week and next week's inflation numbers. And if those do indeed deliver around expectations or don't significantly disappoint, I think in the short term, you're going to see yields press a little bit higher as the market continues to price in tighter Fed policy.
But if you look at oversold conditions, you're right. Yields have been much better behaved last week, starting into this week. We're looking at a different scenario. It just feels to me like there's not a lot of conviction from the market. You know, there's this sort of hope afloat that, okay, maybe the Fed is going to see things and maybe they're going to back off. But the Fed's certainly not sounding that out. All the Fed speakers this week have continued to be very hawkish.
Right. And I think once again, it's this idea of the market loosening the conditions. Now, we can argue that, yes, conditions are tighter than they were 2 months ago. But what you have is that a market that started to rally again. And a lot of this, I think, was driven by external factors. We know that the UK market sold off massively last week. It caused intervention by the BOE. It took a reversal of policy on the tax policy from the prime minister as well. Mm-hmm. And so what you've seen is that the US markets moved a little bit in sympathy with the UK. If you look today, the UK is off commensurate with what we've seen in the US market. So I think you're right that what we're trying to find is what that even keel is within the marketplace. But again, as you said, the Fed governors continue to spit the rhetoric that they want tighter policy. They're going to continue to be inflation fighters. And just look at the dot plots that were released at the FOMC meeting last week. What you have on, if you look at where the dots are, the bulk of the surveys from the various Fed governors is that policy rates should be 100 to 125 basis points higher than they are today. So that means the bond market needs to continue to tighten a little bit. So although I think we're very close to the end of this hiking cycle, and again, this is all going to be predicated on the growth and inflation data and specifically on the labor market. But if we're getting close to those late innings, what that means is that now it's getting to the point where the Treasury yields are a solid buy. And we're looking across the markets. What you're finding out there is that now that we've hit kind of these kind of levels we haven't seen in roughly 11 years or so, it's starting to time to really be able to leg into bonds. You can build high quality portfolios today that allow you to generate yields that are, let's say, roughly 6%+. And if you believe inflation, as we do, is going to come down next year, and maybe it's going to be elevated relative to Fed policy, but let's just say it prints around 4 to 4.5%, that gives you a significant real yield advantage. And so although there's choppiness ahead, we think there are some good opportunities within the bond market today.
Jeffrey, thank you very much. Jeffrey Sherman.
Okay, great to be with you, Becky. Thank you.
Great to see you, too. Now, it does seem like everything in the market has been a victim of the volatility, but there are some stocks that are safe haven plays, some that are more so than others. At least that's according to our next guest, Ann Berry. She's the founder of Threadneedle Ventures. And Ann, first off, we should just say you are not quite as optimistic about the macro environment out here. You're thinking that maybe what we're seeing with the market today is a little bit of a head fake or over the last week.
Becky, I think that's exactly right. To be honest, I've been a bit baffled by some of the rallying that we've seen in the market. And partly it's because, just having spent a lot of time there recently, I look at just how desperate the situation is becoming for the consumer internationally, not just with the US dollar importing inflation to many key trading partners, whether it's Japan or whether it's the UK, for the US, but also in terms of what the impact of this energy war is having, particularly on the European consumer. So I'm a lot more pessimistic, particularly on those stocks that have got global revenue streams than I think the market is right now.
But you do like things that consumers are going to continue to spend on. You break this down kind of into a barbell strategy where you say you like the stuff that they have to spend on and then the luxury items where they're really going to splurge, right?
That's right, Becky. And this really comes from looking back at what happened to consumer behavior in 2008. And by the end of that quarter, about $200 billion of U.S. consumer spending had disappeared relative to the same time the prior year. And at that point, when I was investing, one of the trends that was very clear was consumers were either going towards deep value, they were going to the Dollar Generals, they were going to the Walmarts, they were getting bang for their buck, or they were splurging on luxuries. And in this case, I think that the new luxury actually is premium content, whether it's something like a Netflix subscription or it's something like going to see a concert. You know, it used to be the affordable luxury, it used to be a Starbucks coffee. I think now it's about getting premium content direct to the home.
I did do a little bit of a double take, Anne, when I saw that your idea of luxury these days is Netflix and Spotify. But those are the things that you think people will actually continue to spend on that they don't have to, but they want to.
I think that's exactly right. I think that people do want to have audio coming through to their phone. If you look at music, there's only about 15% penetration of smart devices globally. So there's still a huge tailwind there in terms of addressable market. I'm a believer in Netflix starting to put in place an ad-supported system that's going to get real uptake. And if you think about, Becky, what's been going on with brands, particularly the ones that have been going direct to consumer, they've been crushed by the change in privacy laws that have applied on the Apple system in particular. And they're desperately looking for more effective, more trackable places to spend their marketing dollars. And if something like an Amazon Prime, or in this case, a Netflix can provide it, I do think there's real uplift there.
The stuff that you think they're going to have to spend on, things like Walmart, you point out that there is some foreign exchange concerns there. That's a big headwind for Walmart, but you like it anyway. Why?
Well, I do, because I think about just the sheer scale of that business, Becky, and I also think that Walmart is doing something quite clever behind the scenes, which is investing heavily into new revenue sources down the line, not right now. I think, you know, their fintech innovation, what they're doing in health and wellness delivery in terms of pharmacies and stores is important. But I think, Becky, if I look at deep value, that's why I think Dollar General still has opportunity. It's almost entirely domestically focused. You've got the strong dollar helping to support merchandising and sourcing, but you're still getting domestic revenue without having a hit on Forex.
All right, Ann, so let's just wrap it up for people. Walmart, Dollar General, Petco, Netflix, Spotify, and Live Nation. Those are your picks. I want to thank you for being here today. It's really good to see you.
Thanks, Becky.
All right, folks, don't go anywhere. We are just getting started on this CNBC special, Markets in Motion.
Tonight, oil's well that ends well. With investors on high alert after today's OPEC meeting, we're drilling down on what's next for the sector. Plus, oh, tweet mercy. What Elon Musk's about face means for the stocks of Tesla and Twitter. And the name's Bond. We'll find out if it's time to change your bond strategy amid the uncertainty when we return on CNBC.
Fact. Running a business is not getting easier on your wallet. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. Also a fact, smart businesses are reducing costs and headaches by graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See how you'll profit with NetSuite, and then you can think of all the ways you could be spending the money you save. Company retreat in Malibu, anyone? By popular demand, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com to start saving.
When you're hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. Plus, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mad Money. Just go to Indeed.com/Mad Money right now and support this show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mad Money. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome back to the CNBC special, Markets in Motion. Shares of Twitter up more than 17% since Monday after Elon Musk's on-again, off-again deal to buy the social media company was once again revived yesterday, with Musk now proposing to buy Twitter for, the original deal price of $44 billion. You have to wonder, how the heck is he going to pay for this? Joining us right now to dig into the financials for us is CNBC's Robert Frank. And Robert, I know you've been following the money on this for a very long time. Where do things stand? What's he have? What's he need?
Well, Becky, it's Musk in motion this week because he committed to providing $33 billion in equity for this deal. The question, as you say, is how he's going to raise that money and whether he may need to sell more Tesla shares. This year, he sold $15.5 billion in Tesla stock. First of that was back in April when he tweeted no further sales planned after today. And then he sold again in August. He's getting $7 billion in VC investments from Larry Ellison, Mark Andreessen, and Saudi Arabia. And he has a $4 billion stake in Twitter that he already owns. Assuming that that is included, he now has 27 of the 33 billion he needs. Now that leaves, of course, the 6 billion unfunded. UBS says he may have to pay taxes on the August stock sale, but he may have a lot left over from last year's sales. Bottom line, UBS says he may need to sell at least $10 billion of Tesla stock to fund this deal. Wedbush says he maybe only has to sell about $3 billion. Point is, more sales may be planned. Now, another challenge is the bank debt. Morgan Stanley and others have committed to loans of $12.5 billion, some of which they have to resell to investors. Now, with credit markets so tight right now, they could end up losing hundreds of millions of dollars on these loans, and they may need to offer interest rates of 15% or more just to get investors interested. Becky?
Robert, these sound like big problems, but big problems for the bank, not for this deal potentially going through, right? This is kind of on the banks, and you know they've got 15 days to come up with this, or they can loan their own money out on this, but their problem, not the deal's problem.
That's the best I can tell. There is a widespread theory out there, mainly on Twitter, by wishful thinkers, I think, who think that Elon Musk knows that the bank will not come through with the financing, that the banks are going to renege, so therefore he gets an out on this deal. So therefore this whole thing that he's agreeing to the deal is a charade, and he's going to go to Twitter and say, oh, the banks wouldn't agree to the funding. Sorry, no deal. As far as I can read from the contracts and the commitment letters, this funding is ironclad. The banks are on the hook for this. So I think you're right. The banks don't have an out, and this is just a formality.
Robert, thank you. We'll see you again soon. Our next guest says that Musk really had no choice but to stick with his original offer all along.
Joining us to break this down and to talk about what a Musk-led Twitter could look like is Jim Stewart. He's a CNBC contributor and a New York Times columnist. By the way, Jim, we should also point out to people, on top of being a great author and so many other things, you're a graduate of Harvard Law School, so you know what you're going to speak about in some of these legal issues, too.
Yes, that's correct.
Let's just pick up on where Robert left off. Is there wiggle room in this? Does Twitter, because the judge today actually said that she's going to continue to press on towards trial. They are still negotiating on both sides to come up with something. What does this mean? What does this legalese mean? And how sure should investors be about this deal going through?
Well, obviously, they're not going to stop the trial until there is an actual deal. And from everything that I've heard and read about it, Twitter is taking a very hard line. I mean, for one thing, look, they're not giving him any concession on the price. And they're also insisting that there be no new contingencies, that this be a surefire thing. And they're holding out for that. And I think they can do that because they have the winning hand. I mean, I and other people I've been talking to have been scratching our heads ever since Musk pulled out of this, thinking, on what legal theory did he expect that he could wriggle out of this deal? I have not heard a plausible one. You know, he's been throwing up, you know, various sort of red herrings, like, oh, there were fake accounts, they misrepresented something. He had locked himself into a very firm deal. And in my estimation, none of that was going to prevail in court. So the legal implications of that are either that he was going to lose. I'm sure his lawyers told him he was going to lose. And either the judge, after he spent millions of dollars in litigation, would order him to go through with the deal, or more likely, because judges don't like to do that, would assess the damages that he has caused Twitter by making the bid and then withdrawing. And all you have to do there is start by measuring the price between what he was promising to pay and where Twitter was trading after he pulled out. And you could see he was looking at billions of dollars in damages. So I think for him, this was really, he really had no choice.
Billions of dollars in damages, and then he doesn't get the company anyway? So you get charged
that
fine?
No, he has nothing. Yeah. He pays the damages, and he has absolutely nothing to show for it. That would be a crazy outcome and a terrible one for him personally, both financially and in terms of, you know, any credibility he would have in the market. So I think he really, really did have his back up against a wall here. And honestly, I think he got good legal. If indeed his lawyers said, look, you're going to lose this case, I think he got good legal advice because I think he was going to lose it. Obviously, he hasn't done the deal yet, so we may still get this trial. But I can't imagine that scenario happening.
But if the judge is proceeding with this trial, I mean, he was supposed to get deposed tomorrow. Does that get put off?
That's a good question. Typically, I think it would depend on how close they are to a deal. It doesn't make any sense to go ahead and depose him if they really are close. If not, and I'm Twitter, I'd say, yes, absolutely. Get him in there and keep the pressure on. They have every incentive to do that until he actually does enter into this final agreement.
I mean, it's fun to watch Twitter and see Elon's responses to these things. He responded to one kind of crazy idea today that was floated, one of these crazy ideas where somebody said, you know, during these negotiations, you should use your flex your muscle and your ability to be able to float a rocket over the opposing people's houses. And he responded back that, yeah, not a bad idea, something along those lines.
Well, you know, I have to say, as a journalist, as opposed to a lawyer here, I was looking forward to the trial. There was going to be, you know, it would have been very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of material would have come out. You know, another point I think that nobody's really focused on so much is that he was acting like this Twitter whistleblower was going to be the salvation of his effort to pull out. Like the whistleblowers are going, oh my God, there's fraud, there's all this going on inside the company. But if you look at what the whistleblower actually said, none of it did Musk any good. The whistleblower was saying that Twitter wasn't doing enough to stop additional fake accounts. He never claimed that Twitter had misstated the number of fake accounts. In fact, he specifically said they had not. Twitter has been filing audited financial statements for years, and I think we have to give them the benefit and assume that those are, you know, are accurate. I mean, there are severe penalties if you misstate things in an audit financial statement.
Very quickly, just as a supposition, what do you think the new Twitter looks like under Elon Musk, assuming this deal does go through? Because he's talking about some pretty grand plans at this point.
Well, you know, some of the grand plans that I'm hearing him talk about, like the one app or that sort of thing. I mean,
one
good
app
luck to
rule
him.
Them all.
I mean, he's. I concede he is. He is a genius. He has gone places that everyone else has feared to tread with great success. So, you know, I compliment him for that. But do you think Twitter hasn't thought of this before? They've got a lot of smart people there, starting with Jack Dorsey, number one. Secondly, the one thing I think we can be confident in, he has a very strong libertarian streak. He does not like government interference. He doesn't like the SEC telling him what he can or cannot say. He doesn't like having to comply with the SEC regulations. It will be a libertarian Twitter, which means, you know, I think it's going to be a free for all, that a lot of people who can't get on there now will be there, starting with, you know, the former president. And the question, I think, will be, what will that do to mainstream Twitter users? Now, Twitter does have a very strong, you know, so-called network effect. You know, people want to be on there because that's the biggest audience, and then vice versa. That's something Twitter has going for it. So I think he has some leeway there. But if he goes too far, if it gets taken over by extremists, it's going to alienate the mainstream users. I think that's the risk.
Well, it will be fun and interesting to watch. And Jim, my friend, it's good to see you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks, Becky. Okay.
Still to come on this CNBC special, Markets in Motion. Oil stocks higher on OPEC's big production cut. Where are oil prices going from here? And by the way, what will it mean for the already fragile economy? We've got your power playbook coming up. Plus, as we head to a break, let's take a look at some of the mega cap names, Apple and Microsoft, up today. But Apple was up, but Alphabet, Amazon, Tesla, all trading lower. Tesla tracking for its third straight negative week. We'll be right back.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome back, everybody. Oil closing higher for the day as OPEC Plus announces that it's going to be cutting production by 2 million barrels a day. That is its biggest cut since the start of the pandemic. Brian Sullivan is on the ground in Vienna, where the meeting took place, and joins us now with the details.
Becky, it was a dramatic day here at OPEC headquarters in Vienna, Austria. First in-person meeting in 2.5 years. And I guess the number two is appropriate because it was a 2 million barrel a day cut to future output. Now, the number will not actually be 2 million barrels. It's going to be about 900,000 to 1 million actual barrels because many countries in OPEC were not meeting their quotas anyway. But we know this, that 2 million barrel a day number, that's going to get the screaming headlines in the papers tomorrow morning. It is going to be politicized. We had a chance to sit down with Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, the Saudi energy minister. I asked him why they did it. We talked about economies and the Federal Reserve and interest rates. He said they have to be progressive or proactive and aggressive. Listen.
OPEC Plus had been successful, effective, because we take matters, we are attentive. Now, how we are attentive? Because we take things, measures in a preemptive way, and we make sure that in order to preempt, you have to be assertive. So we have to be assertive, preemptive, and of course, we have to be proactive.
I think certainly aggressive is going to be the term that is being used. This will be politicized, as we know. Certainly Washington, D.C., the White House, they are not going to be happy with this move. Oil prices on the rise once again. Take it for what you will, and however you want to read it, OPEC Plus today with a massive move, one of the biggest production cuts in their history outside of COVID. Becky, back to you.
Brian, thank you very much. Totally understand what Brian's saying, the oil minister, blah, 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 blah. Energy stocks on the rise following the OPEC Plus output cut. The S&P Energy ETF is up nearly 46% so far this year. So could that strength continue in the fourth quarter? Joining us with an outlook for the oil market is Damian Corvalin. He, of course, is Goldman Sachs head of energy research. And Damian, let's just break down this OPEC Plus meeting today. Brian pointed to this. There's all these questions about what just happened. 2 million barrels per day cut, but it's really that's a technical issue, closer to 900,000 barrels per day. What's that going to do to the market?
I think the key really is the market was already tight. Remember, we're record low on inventories, and we're heading into the end of the year in deficit. This only exacerbates the deficit. So for all the concerns on demand and the macro outlook, this is quite bullish, right? This is going to take inventories from record low to even lower level and set the stage, in our view, for a large rally in prices at the end of this year. So, you know, for us, very much a bullish outcome for the oil market.
Yeah, the Saudi oil minister who was talking there, they have to be proactive, blah, 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 blah. Basically, they're saying they didn't like what happened in the third quarter when oil prices were down 25%. But if you're looking year to date, oil prices are still up 17%. So what gives?
So there are three ways to look at this, right? In the short run, I think concerns, of course, have been on the demand side, potential hard landing. And so, you know, prices have followed down 40%. They're responding to that. The second angle is the decline in oil price has actually been much larger than other cyclical asset classes because the volatility in energy, the uncertainty that we face between Chinese lockdown, Russian sanctions, ultimately have led to an exodus of investors. So oil prices are actually pricing in worse than any other asset class. And that's the second reason for this intervention is to connect prices back to, as I said, tight fundamentals. The third one is, look, prices are up year to date, but no one's responding on the supply side. There is no investment increasing from here. And so, you know, responding and supporting prices over the medium term is actually necessary. The policies in place, whether it's SPR, for example, releases, do not solve the underinvestment that we have. And so that's the third angle under which to think of those cuts is we actually need structurally higher prices to avoid depleting inventories even further next year and the year after that.
So I hear your point that they are doing a supply cut. Lower supply leads to higher prices. However, isn't there like the next derivative in this trade where higher oil prices leads to a weaker economy, which leads to a drop in demand? So, you know, how do you balance all of that out?
It's a difficult one, right? So think of the analogy of the 1970s. You know, think of the Volcker hikes. They came in after a decade of high prices and significant investment in new supply. Today, you know, the Fed is hiking, killing demand with underinvestment for the last 10 years. So this is actually much worse. This dilemma you described is really, you can't have demand because you can't have supply. But if you want to create supply, you're going to hurt demand. So that's, I think, what the market is stuck with. And on average, I think we have to acknowledge that $90 just isn't the price at which anyone is investing. So that's just not a sustainable outcome. And staying here artificially only makes next year's growth outlook, the year after that, even more challenging because we definitely will see at that point record high prices to finally create supply that no one's investing in today.
Damian, I realize you're not a political analyst, but I will say I was not shocked to see the Saudis saying that they were going to cut 500,000 barrels per day. Not a huge spread, or 500 million barrels per day. That doesn't shock me, doesn't surprise me with any of those things, that 500,000. But hearing that the UAE and Kuwait were kind of on board with this did surprise me to a certain extent. They're supposed to be our allies. I thought if anybody was going to hold out and maybe raise their hand and give us a little bit of room for relief, it would be them. What gives?
So, look, I think the group is operating as one, right? The coalition has been strong, and this decision has been unanimous. It was a very quick meeting in the end. Look, the reality that prices are down 40%, you know, applies to all of them. And in the end, I think the response, which, again, you can argue is either short-term defensive relative to demand, long-term trying to anticipate this supply under investment, look, is applies to all of them. In a way, right, you know, cynically if you want, but high oil prices that actually exacerbate the economic downturn are actually bad for all those producers, right? They don't benefit from a recession, neither does China on a global scale. So to some extent, they're trying to thread this, okay, we have to somewhat respond to lower prices, but somewhat also maintain investment. I think they are all very much on the same page here.
Meaning that you don't expect to see additional big cuts to supply?
So, look, I think the next move very much at that point will depend on how the economic outlook shapes in the next few months, and then the Russia shortfall in production once the European embargo goes through. Our base case is this cut today is actually not sustainable. Like that leads by next year to a significant spike in prices. So we base case it for the next 3 months, but we think it's just not sustainable given how tight the oil market is. Because at that point, you really get to that demand destructive price level, well above $100 per barrel.
Damian, thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
All right, folks, we are just past the bottom of the hour. That means we get to bring you up to speed on today's market action. The Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all ending the day slightly lower, but they had a late-day rally that got them really out of a deep hole. The major averages at this point snapping a two-day winning streak, but down by about 0.25% or less across the board. Now, the futures opening just a short time ago, and here's where they stand right now. You're going to see the Dow futures basically flat. S&P futures, the same story. NASDAQ, pretty much all of them flat, waiting to see what happens next, up by about 1.8. Of course, it's early trading, very thin trading at this point. Before we head to a break, despite the averages closing down today, there were some stocks hitting 52-week highs, Lamb Weston and PG&E. Stay with us.
Coming up, bear market bounce or something much bigger? What the technicals are signaling for the month of October. Plus, forget James Bond, why bonds have people talking in this market. And is cash king? We'll find out if the asset class has retaken its crown when we return on CNBC.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Now to the bond market. Bank of America's MOVE index, which tracks volatility in the bond market, has more than doubled this year. You already know that if you've been watching these markets, but it's seeing higher levels of volatility now than during the COVID-19 outbreak, and it's only ever been higher during the 2008 global financial crisis. Uh-oh. Let's take a closer look at what's ahead with Kamal Srikumar. He is the president of Srikumar Global Strategies. And Sri, a lot of people breathing a sigh of relief. We've seen things calm down in the markets, but you think it's a little too soon for the euphoria. You want to explain why?
Sure. It was euphoria, as we know, Becky, Monday and Tuesday in the equity market. But the treasury market did not share in the euphoria today, quite markedly. And you don't see that in other major bond markets as well. The German 10-year Bund yield increased. The UK 10-year gilt yield is more than 4% again. So you essentially have a bear market in bonds. And I am a person who believes that the bond market has been a better predictor of the Federal Reserve policy as well as the future of the economy than equity markets have been. Remember, you referred to 2007-2008, Becky. October 2007, the S&P 500 hit an all-time record high. So if you were standing then, the U.S. economy was poised for several years of rapid growth. Yet the Great Recession began 3 months later. The bond market was already suggesting a recession. So what is happening today? We have the 2 to 10-year yield curve remains inverted. It has been inverted significantly since early July, and that is suggesting a recession. And even though there was all of this optimism about a Fed pivot in the last couple of days, look at what the numbers are suggesting. We have the OPEC Plus meeting results going to push up gasoline prices. It is going to push up overall inflation. Today, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta GDP Now Index shows plus 2.7% growth for the third quarter. That doesn't seem like a weakening economy to me. Also, the services index of the Institute of Supply Management shows strength. ADP numbers for private sector job growth, which is a precursor to our Friday big jobs report, that was a healthy one. So there is no slowdown. The Fed cannot pivot. The Fed will pivot, in my opinion, only when just when that happens, and that is something has to break. Financial institutions in the United States are said to be very strong, unlike 2007, 2008. But whoever thought that the problems would arise from the UK pension funds, right? And that's where it originated. We are going to have problems in the US. We simply don't know where they are going to come from, Becky.
I'm with you on that. If we see a Fed pivot, it may not be this good relief reason that a lot of people are anticipating. You made a big call on Squawk Box last week where you said you think the 10-year has topped out at 4%. If you're looking at all these reasons for the Fed not to pivot yet, why do you think that we have hit this point where, you know, we've kind of seen the end of the interest rate acceleration when it comes to yields?
That's a great question, Becky, and a very timely one. And let me respond this way. That is that when it hit 4%, I thought the 4% figure incorporates or discounts within it many of the factors that I mentioned. And at the same time, we are going to go into a recession, and I had to make a quick calculation as to when the recession would set in and the demand destruction takes place compared with higher bond yields. As you know, having been, as we have been together on Squawk Box over the last 2 years, I've been looking for higher and higher yields. Mm-hmm. But right now, it seems to me that the turning point has come. All of the negatives are incorporated in the higher bond yield, which is why I think 4% is the top. Can you go to 4.10? Sure. I'm not absolutely stuck to a 4% figure, but we are not talking of 5 or 6% on the 10-year at all.
Sri, thank you. By the way, I like your tie. We match today. We're thinking alike. Good to see you, Sri.
That means a lot to me.
I will see you soon. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, after the break, is this week's market jump a classic bear market bounce or the start of a more sustainable comeback? We're going to see what the technicals are signaling. That's when the CNBC special Markets in Motion continues. Welcome back to the CNBC special, Markets in Motion. As stocks continue to swing from day to day, our next guest says seasonality could signal an opportunity on the horizon. Let's go to the charts with Jessica Inskeep. She's Options Play Director of Product and Education for More. Jessica, what are you seeing? Do you want to explain that? Where's the opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. So seasonality, definitely from a technical perspective, looks like that we have a wonderful setup. So when we have a particularly challenging September, which we did, the S&P 500 was down 9.3%. That's normally followed by a very lucrative or a really great bounce for the second or the fourth quarter of the year into the first half of the year. That occurs 91% of the time with an average turn of 16.6%. That's inclusive backdating all the way to 1928 and inclusive of a midterm year, which is extremely important. Now, know that those data points are just purely looking at patterns and events, and we have a lot of macro headwinds. However, that seasonality perspective certainly provides an optimal setup.
So that means basically we're up more than 5% this week, but we were really sold off. So maybe there's more upside to come.
Absolutely. Nailed it.
Okay. So where are we talking about in terms of support levels, in terms of resistance? What are you kind of watching right now? Where's the bands?
Yeah. So for the bigger picture, I like to take a look at a weekly chart. When you take a look at a weekly chart, it filters away the noise, especially with high volatility. If you take a look at the 200 weekly moving average, this is particularly important as a form of support. If you look at the chart backdating to all of the major declines, and when we look for a reversal, it's important that we're above this line, and this indicates a true bull market when above the 200 weekly moving average. So something I talk about quite often. And in addition to that, when we're trying to spot bullish divergence, I like to use MACD or RSI. MACD in particular, because it uses an EMA, which puts more weight on recent prices, which will give us an indication of divergence. So as you can see on the chart, if the underlying, or S&P in this case, makes a lower low, but MACD makes a higher high, mm-hmm. So those forward-looking prices, then that's an indication of bullish divergence. That is forming. It is purely a signal. It is not confirmed, and that's an important component just to watch. So to look for those signals or really drill in, we have to take a look and bring on some of that noise and look at a daily chart.
We have a couple of big events coming up. You've got the jobs report on Friday. You've got an inflation report coming next week. And so much of this market has been driven just on the idea that, holy cow, what's the Fed going to do next? What do each of these data points mean? Could this be a situation where the volatility really increases over the next several sessions?
Absolutely. And if you study bear markets overall, volatility is just ever so high. And going back all the way, I believe it's even 20 years, the best performing days within the S&P 500 are during bear markets. Due to that volatility, it's also on the upside. So absolutely, I expect that, because the market's going to digest and try to understand the actual equilibrium and the price at which it should be. And now there's more retail players within the market, more technology, so we react more often, so that volatility is heightened.
Jessica, thank you.
Thank you, Becky. Mm-hmm.
When we come back, legendary investor Ray Dalio making a major U-turn earlier this week, saying he no longer thinks cash is trash. So is it time to add the greenback to your investing strategy? We're going to dig into that asset class next. Plus, don't go anywhere. The news with Shepard Smith kicks off at the top of the hour. This CNBC special, Markets in Motion, will be back right after this. Welcome back. The S&P 500 closing down almost 5% in the third quarter as prior to that broad market rout. According to Bank of America, cash was the only major asset class to actually gain in the third quarter, ending up about 0.5%. Even noted cash is trash investor Ray Dalio saying yesterday he's actually changed his mind when it comes to the liquid asset class. Let's bring in Daniel Girard, senior multi-asset strategist at State Street Global Markets. And Daniel, Ray's position always made sense to me. Cash is trash, especially when you're in an inflationary environment, because your purchasing power is worth less. What does he see that's changed his mind, and what do you think?
Yeah, look, I think that it's got some merit to it. I think, we can all remember, not all of us, but many of us remember years ago when you got 8 or 9% in a savings account, and it made a lot of sense. But of course, recently with high inflation, with sort of an updraft in other asset markets, it didn't make a lot of sense. That's changing. We're in a period now with not a lot of historical context. The Fed is trying to normalize monetary policy. They will continue to do so. When we need to look through the current markets with this lens of inflation, and I think that means that this, stock bond correlation continues. And that means correlation is they're both going to go down for a while until the Fed gets a handle on inflation.
And bond prices, but yields go up, right?
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. Right. That means that we are, really looking at some ultra short duration for now, as the USD is your best friend at this point, I think. It's a tough one. There's going to be a bottom at some point, and I don't mean for people not to be investing in these markets, but it is cash has some merit now.
Cash has some merit, even when inflation is high, if you think stocks continue to go down, if you think other investments are going to be cheaper, more cheaply priced, too. Right. You just think the Fed is not at the pivot point yet, right?
I don't. Look, I think we have two overlapping periods here. We've got a period where the Fed has been trying for years to normalize policy to get to some neutral level. And at the same time, they've got to move further than that and fight inflation. They've barely gotten to the normalization point yet. Whether or not we're at neutral, the economy tells us that. We don't tell the economy that. And if you look at credit growth continues to be very strong in the U.S. And that's a problem. The Fed has managed to tamp down money supply growth, but it's really because money's coming out of the securities portfolios. There's deleveraging happening in the financial markets, not in the real economy. Goods and services continue to move higher as credit expands for both businesses and consumers. That's not a neutral environment. The Fed's going to have to work harder.
Usually when you see rising interest rates, people like the financials because they figure you're actually going to be able to get some sort of spread, credit spread. The banks will actually make out on stuff like that. But this is different timing because the Fed is raising into the potential for a recession. You say sell financials on any potential rallies that you see here. Why is that?
I think that's exactly right. Financials make sense when you have rising rates because you've got a better shaped curve in some view that the economy is actually getting stronger, that there'll be better demand ahead. The problem is that there actually is too much loan demand right now, which means this rising rates, the point of the rising rates is to tamp down business and consumer credit. I think that that's going to be very tough, especially with difficult capital requirements. And, we haven't even talked about, new capital requirements coming in, in the near future. This is something where I don't think banks actually do particularly well this time around. This is something where any good news, if you have good news this earnings season, from Q3 earnings season, take it, bank it.
15 seconds, the one asset class, one place you would put your money in equities, energy?
Energy. I like it. I've been saying this for a little while. I think that we've misunderstood what's happening here. This has been a supply issue. OPEC, confirmed to us this week that they don't like this idea that, we're trying to sell repo energy oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. There's a real structural issue. So I think energy is going higher and there's not much we can do about it.
Daniel Girard, thank you very much. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being with us tonight, everybody. I hope you have a great evening. That does it for us tonight. The news with Shepard Smith starts right now.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.